Thank you all for coming, and please be seated. The meaning of Rome. Veni, vidi, vici. I came, I saw, I overcame. If a place is somewhere that human beings can go, then the Romans can come there. If something can be seen by human beings, then the Romans can see it. And if something can be possessed by a human being, then the Romans can take it. This is the meaning of Rome. This is expressed chillingly well in the Gospel of John. There it is known that if you attract their attention, quote, the Romans shall come and take away our place and nation. This is the meaning of Rome for other nations. And this is the meaning of Rome for Britain in Shakespeare's Cymbeline. Cymbeline opens its first act with the entrance of two gentlemen. These gentlemen are merely called first gentleman and second gentleman. They speak alone together for some 70 lines, exit before any others come onto the stage, and do not appear again in the play. One may surmise of the first gentleman that he knows well the court of Britain, and of the second gentleman that he is not familiar with the court. In the exchange between the two gentlemen, the four major plot elements of the play emerge with relative distinctness. We are told that King Cymbeline's daughter, Imogen, has married, quote, a poor but worthy gentleman, Posthumus Leonidas. We are also told that some 20 years ago, the king's two other children were stolen from their nursery, and that to this hour, the court has, quote, no guess in knowledge which way they went. Now, some astonishment or perhaps blame is expressed that the children of a king could be taken away so easily, and that the resources of the throne could not discover and recover the children. These two plot elements are explicit, with the second being conveyed as a supplement to the first. The absence of the prior heirs makes this unauthorized marriage a more serious matter. The two other major plot elements of the play appear in more muted fashion within these sparing exchanges between the unnamed gentlemen. We are told that lately the king has remarried, and that it is this new queen that most desired the match between her son and the king's daughter that has been thwarted by Imogen's marriage to Posthumus. Thus we find that the queen has plans, and that her plans and those of the king do not have the same extent. We are also told, in the course of relaying Posthumus's history, that his father earned the family surname, Leonidas, in war against the Romans. Thus we find that this Briton has a recent history of conflict with Rome. The whole rest of the play centers around these four major plot elements: the marriage of Imogen and Posthumus, the mysterious abduction of the king's two sons, the queen's and her son's plot against the kingdom, and the conflict between Britain and Rome. One overarching thought unites these four elements: the thought of having things that are one's own, and of resisting the efforts toward and claims against the things we think we own or wish to own that are made by others. The very opening lines point to this theme. Quote, you do not meet a man but frowns. Our bloods no more obey the heavens than our courtiers still seem, as does the king's. Men are small things compared to the heavens, and those of lower status are small compared to the king. And every nation is small compared to Rome. The opening lines raise the question of what, if anything, we may have that is our own within the context of a world with such great powers in it. Only about six lines later, the first gentleman modifies his image of all men being in the sway of higher powers by stating, quote, "All is outward sorrow, though I think the king be touched at very heart." This modification allows the possibility of courtiers who frown on the outside to give the appearance of going along with the king, but who are not frowning on the inside. What does having such an inside give to us? Does it give us indisputably secure private possessions, safely locked away somewhere impenetrable and unassailable? Part one, manacles of love. Perhaps the most natural and promising aspect of the play to look to when inquiring about the character and possibilities of the heart is the love story. And there are other reasons to look to the love story as well. It is simply the most prominent feature of the whole play. The love story of Posthumus and Imogen seems to have everything required to make a viscerally powerful tragedy. Two lovers, without the consent or knowledge of family, and perhaps in despite of social convention and political plans, make a marriage. They have barely been united when the king, angry that his plan, which is really the queen's plan, has been ruined, and therefore he separates the lovers by exiling Posthumus. Now, although this marriage is a breach of custom, it may be viewed as the kind of marriage that is built upon the strongest and most reasonable of foundations. Posthumus is a man of no particular social standing. He is an orphan, born after both of his parents were dead, hence his name, Posthumus. He has been taken up and raised as a ward of the kingly court. What he brings to his marriage with Imogen are no titles or wealth, no status, no conventional value attending the office of his person. He brings only his own person, with its properties, qualities, and virtues. The testimony to his virtues are considerable. The first gentleman describes Posthumus as, quote, "a creature such as to seek through the regions of the earth for one his like, there would be something failing in him that should compare. I do not think so fair an outward and such stuff within endows a man but he." Posthumus is also an unusually prodigious learner who makes great use of all the educational opportunities of the court. The king puts to him all the learnings that his time could make him the receiver of, which he, Posthumus, took as we do air, fast as 'twas ministered, and in his spring became a harvest. Perhaps the greatest testimony to the excellence of Posthumus's personal merits is how generally well-liked he is at court while still being a good influence upon all the courtiers. Posthumus, quote, "lived in court, which rare it is to do, most praised, most loved, a sample to the youngest, to the more mature a glass that feeded them, to the graver a child that guided daughters." Posthumus is a kind of self-made man who has made himself into a man of the kind of excellence that seems to give good grounds for marriage, for lifelong preference to all other men. There seems to be every reason to think that Imogen has married Posthumus and preferred him to all others on the grounds of his excellence. Further, there seem to be many reasons in the play to think that Imogen is similarly possessed of many personal excellences. However, this marriage founded on matched excellences barely gets a chance to get going before it is discovered and the king banishes Posthumus. The way that Posthumus and Imogen part from each other under this enforced necessity makes clear that even this excellently founded marriage is infused through and through with possessiveness. This is not so strange. Although it might be perverse to call possessiveness the essence of marriage, maybe the essence of marriage is more properly love. But the love is usually an exclusive love. Marital vows of fidelity mean that the love of each partner, at least the erotic love, is to be perpetually the sole possession of the other partner. When Posthumus and Imogen part, they exchange jewelry as symbols of their mutual and exclusive bond to one another. The jewelry represents chains. Imogen gives a precious diamond ring. She says, "This diamond was my mother's. Take it, heart, but keep it till you woo another wife when Imogen is dead." Her gift is more modest in the scope of its assertion of ownership. She gives a ring that once belonged to another, her mother, a woman who has died and whose husband has remarried. Imogen only asserts her ownership over Posthumus for so long as she should live. But Posthumus does not want to hear of his outlasting his love and remarrying. He goes so far as to pray for death in preference to any life involving the transfer of his love to a second wife. He gives Imogen a more modest piece of jewelry, a bracelet, presumably in keeping with his means. But his ambition to have and to own his beloved is less modest. Quote, "For my sake, wear this. It is a manacle of love. I'll place it upon this fairest prisoner." Part two, a not altogether slight quarrel. Thus begins the exile of Posthumus and the testing of these chains of love. Left behind in Britain, Imogen must stand up to the pressure of her father's urging of divorce and the plots of her stepmother. The stepmother is never given a proper name, but only referred to as the queen. This is perhaps because although she very much wishes to have things that are her own, she may regard all the things of the world as made up of universals that may be transferred from one human being to another. Her own experience of the world is one of rising by acquiring things that once belonged to another. Her notion of having something of one's own is that of taking something from others and then defending the possession. Her solution to the problem posed by Rome seems to be to become Rome. This woman is said, quote, to bear all down with her brain. Imogen is left alone with her, with only her own resources to contend with this wicked stepmother. It is an exquisite touch of Shakespeare's that the first lines he puts into the queen's mouth refer directly to the tired trope of the wicked stepmother. Quote, "No, be assured you shall not find me, daughter, after the slander of most stepmothers evil-eyed unto you." Now, shortly thereafter, in the fifth scene of Act One, we see this queen soliciting a learned doctor to teach her about and to acquire for her use deadly poisons. The queen pretends that she is merely furthering her chemical education, that previously had extended to mixing perfumes to please the king. She promises to use the poisons merely for experiment and to kill only worthless beings like cats and dogs. Imogen is also plagued by being courted by the queen's oafish son, Cloten. Although much less dangerous than the queen, Cloten is more annoying, and because he is likely capable of crude violence, he is immediately dangerous. On a less literal level, Cloten's attempts to court this already married Imogen constitute an attempt to assault the very notion that human beings can have inviolable private inner possessions. Cloten treats Imogen's attachment to her husband as a nut to be cracked. He has been advised to try to woo her with music. Thus, he brings musicians outside Imogen's apartments. But Cloten does not see this as an attempt to win Imogen's affections by pleasing her. He views the music as a weapon to be used to penetrate the walls of her dwelling and to breach her seclusion against her will. He thinks the way to the inner person can be forced, just as the outer person can be. In the course of 17 lines, Cloten repeats the word penetrate 3 times. His language is crudely sexual, although I would not insist that Cloten has enough self-understanding to be fully aware of what he is saying. Quote, "Come on, tune. If you can penetrate her with your fingering so, we'll try with tongue, too." Later in the same scene, Cloten tries to bribe one of Imogen's ladies to work on her on his behalf. He thinks of gold much as he thinks of music. Quote, "'Tis gold which buys admittance, oft it doth, yea, and makes Diana's rangers false themselves. What can it not do and undo?" Cloten thinks that the inner human being can be reached by gold, which he treats as not only a universal exchange for external goods, but as a universal solvent. The very first appearance of Cloten begins with a comment about changing clothes. Cloten had made an ineffectual assault upon Posthumus as the latter departed into exile, and the effort has made Cloten smell bad. A lord attending him advises he change his shirt because, quote, "where air comes out, air comes in." The lord's comment makes a clear distinction between outside and inside. Cloten rejects the advice and the distinction. He says, quote, "if my shirt were bloody, then shift it." Smell does not show, so there's no need to change the shirt. Cloten denies the distinction between inside and outside. For him, a human being is entirely or effectually, only the properties that are public and in principle accessible to all. For him, the private is just another place in the world that only requires the right power to enter. As stupid as Cloten is, his denial of the distinction between inner and outer is one of the challenges of the play. While Imogen is facing the challenges of the king and the queen and Cloten, the exiled Posthumus is traveling about the world and getting embroiled in quarrels. He is also attracting unfriendly attention. We first see Posthumus in exile in the house of a family friend of his father's, one Filario. This house is in Italy. Before Posthumus enters, he is talked about by both an Italian and a Frenchman. A Dutchman and a Spaniard are present, but silent throughout the scene. It is an international scene. One might say it is a scene played before the whole world. The Italian Iacomo is the first to speak. Note the similarity of his name to that of Othello's Iago. You have just met the principal villain of the play. When he first says, what he first says, seems to indicate he has developed some resentment against Posthumus or against Posthumus's lofty reputation. Quote, "Believe it, sir, I have seen him in Britain. He was then of a crescent note, expected to prove so worthy as since he hath been allowed the name of. But I could then have looked on him without the help of admiration, though the catalogue of his endowments had been tabled by his side, and I to peruse him by items." Filario responds to this by indicating that excellence of personal character is not something that shows itself impressively to the human eye. Quote, "You speak of him when he was less furnished than now he is, with that which makes him, both without and within." Filario is directly referring to Posthumus marrying the princess heir, as if that match matches his inner merit. Now the Frenchman pipes up and echoes Iacomo's resentment. Quote, "I have seen him in France. We had very many there could behold the sun with as firm eyes as he." This resentment provides the background for what comes next and can serve as the human motive for the actions Iacomo takes against Posthumus. But we should not lose sight of the possibility that this resentment could represent a principled objection to the kind of superlative praise that is found in Posthumus's reputation. Perhaps Iacomo represents the objection that no human being should be praised in such terms. And this might be due to the thought that even personal excellences of character are possessions subject to invasion, theft, and destruction. Posthumus enters the scene, and the Frenchman turns the conversation to the circumstances of their prior acquaintance. The Frenchman reveals that he reconciled Posthumus with another Frenchman when the two had had a quarrel. The Frenchman says, quote, "It had been pity you should have been put together with so mortal a purpose as then each bore upon importance of so slight and trivial a nature." Posthumus begs the Frenchman's pardon, and he explains that he was then but an inexperienced youth. However, like the learner he is reputed to be, Posthumus claims to have, quote, "mended his judgment since then." Posthumus tends to refer to learning as mending. So it is perhaps surprising that Posthumus's mended judgment does not seem to reverse his original opinion. He expresses it modestly, quote, "My quarrel was not altogether slight." But the sequel makes it apparent that Posthumus still regards the dispute as one worth risking either killing a man or being killed by one. And what was the dispute? Quote, "It was much like an argument that fell out last night, where each of us fell in praise of our country mistresses, this gentleman at that time vouching, and upon warrant of bloody affirmation, his to be more fair, virtuous, wise, chaste, constant, qualified, and less attemptable than any of the rarest of our ladies in France." This is how the Frenchman tells it. And it seems to be the way he understands what occurred. It is no wonder he thinks the matter trivial and is puzzled by a human being who imposes life or death stakes upon such a dispute. But Iacomo understands better. Posthumus was praising his wife, not the women of his country. And while he may have only asserted his wife to be superior to the women of France, he meant she was superior to all women. Iacomo makes it more explicit. Quote, "You must not so far prefer her for ours of Italy." Posthumus does not hesitate to affirm this. Iacomo makes one statement before this question, and this statement is a sort of implied question. Quote, "That lady is not now living, or this gentleman's opinion by this worn out." Iacomo seems to imply that long experience and the chances of the world would reveal any such lofty, superlative opinion to be false. Only the dead, who are no longer revealing what they truly are, might escape the fate of a fallen estimation. But Posthumus asserts his lady to be still among the living, and his estimation to be still unfallen. Now Iacomo goes on to try to show the unreasonableness of praising any lady in such lofty terms. Quote, "If she went before others I have seen, as that diamond of yours outlusters many I have beheld, I could not but believe she excelled many. But I have not seen the most precious diamond that is, nor you the lady." Iacomo has noticed the diamond ring and deduced, perhaps, that it is a token or symbol of Posthumus's marriage. Iacomo uses the ring as an example to point out the unreasonable character of Posthumus's claims. The literal claim is that Posthumus has not seen the most precious lady. But this cannot be strictly maintained. If there is a standard by which such things can be properly judged, then somewhere in the world, there is the most precious lady, just as there is the most precious diamond. It is not impossible for someone to have seen them. The more reasonable point is that in the whole wide world, there are many ladies and many diamonds, and without knowing all of them, you cannot know which is the best. Although Iacomo's correction should mend Posthumus's extreme, in principle, superlative claims, it does not. Posthumus's resistance to a sober reckoning of what he can and cannot know could be ascribed to the pressures of exile, or to some serious character flaw, or to some defect in the kind of education he has. But I think it is more fruitful to see that it is the logic of marriage itself that has driven Posthumus to his exaggerated and insufficiently grounded claims. What could fully and rationally justify marriage? What could justify granting to one person alone, in perpetuity, sole ownership of your heart and body? Must not that one person be superior to all other persons you might happen to meet? Must not the superiority of that person be lasting, and the recognition of that superiority be based upon the highest authority available to human beings? Now, one candidate for that highest authority is reason. And this is why Posthumus tries to list out qualities or virtues of Imogen that serve as the justifiable grounds for a rational preference of Imogen above all other possible women. Imogen must be, quote, "a shop of all the qualities that man loves woman for." And she must have these lovable qualities in the superlative sense. Every exclusive marriage must implicitly make the same claim. And thus, every marriage is an offense to every other marriage. Since the commitment of marriage is for one's whole life, it makes sense that the stakes of marriage are life and death. Further, Posthumus's willingness to fight to the death other men who deny the claims that justify his marriage can be seen is an aspect of his attempt to understand his marriage as a thing founded in reason. Reason addresses concepts, universal properties. It is public in its nature. It matters to reason what gets said. Now, perhaps the reasoning that animates Posthumus's exaggerated claims about Imogen would have to be made about him as well in order to justify her reciprocal devotion to him. Imogen certainly seems inclined to make such claims. Quote, she calls him a man worth any woman, overbuys me almost the sum he pays. Posthumus is reluctant to proclaim himself superlative or of matching worth with his wife. Instead, he tells Iachimo that Imogen is, quote, only the gift of the gods. Now, Iachimo responds with the pointed question, which the gods have given you? Proclaiming marriage to be under the providential guidance of the gods, wherein your spouse is granted you by supernatural disposition, could be another way to justify marriage. Such a justification would not satisfy the strong human desire to have something of their own, however, because what the gods grant, they can also take away. It may also fail to satisfy the desire of a human being to have something of their own if the having does not engage and incorporate the human capacity for reason. Iachimo's pointed question begs for a reasoned account of why the gods have granted this special person to you. Part 3, Strange Fowl. After these attempts to dispute Posthumus's claims and to illuminate their weaknesses, Iachimo announces something that could serve as the thesis statement of Rome itself. Quote, you may wear her in title yours, but you know, strange fowl light upon neighboring ponds. Your ring may be stolen, too, so your brace of unprizable estimations, the one is but frail and the other casual. A cunning thief or a that way accomplished courtier would hazard the winning both of first and last. Posthumus's attempt to found his love on reason may make it particularly vulnerable to the claims of this Roman thesis. What is accessible to one man's reason can be what can be a possession of thought is in principle accessible to another man's reason. If Imogen has reasons for loving Posthumus, then in principle, those same reasons could exist in another man. Posthumus's denial of the Roman thesis that if one bird can land upon a pond, then so too may a strange fowl leads Posthumus to make a bet with Iachimo. With some cajoling, Iachimo manages to provoke Posthumus to bet his inestimable diamond ring against 10,000 ducats that Iachimo cannot seduce Imogen. It is with some recognition of the wrongness of this wager that Posthumus tells Iachimo that should he fail, quote, for your ill opinion and the assault you made to her chastity, you shall answer me with your sword. Now, as ugly as such a wager is between a husband and a relative stranger, especially when the husband is to provide means for that stranger to have a private audience with the wife, we should also see here a clash of principles between the British desire to have private and unassailable possessions and the Roman assertion that anything one man can have, another can take. Posthumus lays his wager on the side of his well-founded marriage. The woman who is his own cannot be had by another man. Quote, my mistress exceeds in goodness, the hugeness of your unworthy thinking. On Iachimo's side is the Roman reasoning that a woman who already has a husband is open to the approach of man. That Iachimo is more interested in challenging Posthumus's principle than he is in making a conquest is indicated when he says, quote, "I make my wager rather against your confidence than her reputation. And to bar your offense herein too, I durst attempt it against any lady in the world." Part 4, Dragons of the Night. Well, Iachimo makes his way to Britain, and he makes his attempt upon Imogen. The manner of his attempt shows how powerful Iachimo believes the desire to have one's own is. After a few exchanges with Imogen in which she is eager to be told news of Posthumus, Iachimo makes his one and only attempt to seduce her. He gives reports of how Posthumus is merrily living it up in exile. These reports work their way upon Imogen to the point where she says, "My lord, I fear, has forgot Britain, and also, let me hear no more." Imogen is still not wholly convinced yet that Posthumus has betrayed her. She is repeating in this scene the phrase, "If this be true." But Iachimo pounces on this moment and proposes that Imogen take revenge, that she get even. He puts himself forward as the means for her revenge. The seduction has this simple form of trying to convince Imogen that she has lost something of her own and offering her the opportunity to get something back for herself. "You can use me," he offers. The offer does not work. Iachimo's failed attempt at seduction does not match up well with the great confidence he seems to have in his Roman thesis. It is not characteristic of Rome to make but one attempt at conquest and then give up. Presumably, the manner in which Iachimo attempts to seduce Imogen is the one that he thinks has the best chance of success. His Roman thesis, in its broadest application, still offers other avenues of conquest, avenues that may not be available to Iachimo, the individual. The most straightforward avenue, and the one most in line with Iachimo's foremost criticisms of Posthumus's boasts, would have been to attempt to win Imogen's heart by exceeding Posthumus's virtues. It would seem that if he were truly simply an honest advocate of a thesis out to prove its truth, Iachimo would return to Italy and pay the forfeit. Instead, Iachimo stays in Britain. He manages to convince Imogen that his attempt upon her was merely a test, and he is actually still a friend and admirer of Posthumus. He further manages to convince Imogen that he is transporting a valuable gift for the Roman emperor, a gift owned by Posthumus and a group of friends. And so he gets Imogen to offer to store the trunk bearing this gift in her own bedchamber for safekeeping. Iachimo hides himself in that trunk and comes out at night when Imogen is asleep. Iachimo seems to intend to use this trick to gather enough seeming evidence to trick Posthumus into thinking the seduction succeeded. However, he is distracted by Imogen's form and his desire for her, quote, "that I might touch, but kiss, one kiss." He has to recall himself to his plan. He says, "but my design, to note the chamber." Iachimo meticulously notes features of the room and its furnishings. He then seems to think further and makes notes on the features of Imogen's body, noticing a mole under her left breast. Then he slips Posthumus's bracelet, his manacle of love, off of Imogen's arm. Iacomo seems to understand that this bracelet is a token from Posthumus, perhaps because of the smallness of its conventional monetary value, marks it out as likely to have come from a poorer man. Having thus acquired such powerful seeming evidence, Iacomo crawls back into his trunk to wait for the right moment to get away. Iacomo seems powerfully affected by fear as the scene comes to a close, and he is secreting himself once again within the trunk. Quote, "Swift, swift, you dragons of the night, that dawning may bear the raven's eye, I lodge in fear, though this a heavenly angel, hell is here." Is Iacomo afraid of what he has just done, or of what he intends to do, or of what he is tempted to do? We should note that despite his cynical toughness or his sober realism, Iacomo is much affected by Imogen. His first view of her almost destroys his confidence in his thesis. Quote, "All of her that is out of door most rich. If she be furnished with a mind so rare, she is alone the Arabian bird, and I have lost the wager." He is inclined to think about Imogen and feel about her in a way that is very similar to the way Posthumus thinks and feels about Imogen. And yet, there are darker overtones in this scene. He has snuck in. They are alone. She is asleep. Iacomo's second line upon emerging compares his own behavior to that of a historical rapist. Quote, "Our Tarquin thus did softly press the rushes ere he wakened the chastity he wounded." The book Imogen had been reading before bed tells the story of another historical rapist. Although taking things by force is certainly part of the broader understanding of the Roman thesis, a violent assault upon Imogen is not thought of by either contender as something that would constitute winning the bet. In his announcement of his Roman thesis, Iacomo claims, quote, "A cunning thief could steal Posthumus's ring." Is the thought that something could be one's own not challenged just as much by violence as by cunning? Iacomo shudders at the dragons of the night, but did he not bring them into the room? Part 5, paying to wear our own noses. Noticing that the thought of having something of one's own is not as threatened by the prospect of force as by the prospect of seduction, we might wonder why. It is likely because seduction, although it is literally a misleading, is thought to reach the inner person and in some way engage the willingness of the person seduced. Violence is thought merely to be something that happens against the will of the violated. Is paying tribute a willing or unwilling action? Cymbeline's Britain, mainly at the urging of Cymbeline's queen, has stopped paying tribute to Rome. The politics of Britain seems to parallel the defiance of the Roman thesis earlier exemplified in Posthumus's wager. What is sought by Britain, the nation, is like what is sought by private human beings who lay claim to having things that are their own. Britain's assertion of its independence is mostly presented in the first scene of Act 3. In the face of the Roman ambassador, Cotton expresses the assertion of Britain's independence thusly, quote, "Britain's a world by itself, and we will nothing pay for wearing our own noses." In the same conference, Cymbeline expresses the thought of shaking off the yoke of Rome as something that, quote, "becomes a warlike people." Being one's own is a natural and proper desire for a nation. Cymbeline further tells the ambassador, quote, you must know, till the injurious Romans did extort the tribute from us, we were free. Being free means being one's own. It does not mean being unruled by anyone. For Cymbeline thinks of throwing off the Roman yoke as a return to Britain's tradition of giving itself its own laws. Quote, our ancestor was that Mulmutius which ordained our laws, whose use the sword of Caesar hath too much mangled, whose repair and franchise shall, by the power we hold, be our good deed, though Rome be therefore angry. Cymbeline seems to be motivated by the thought that it would be a great accomplishment for his kingship to restore to Britain its autonomy. To his thinking, Britain's effort at independence is just the natural expression of something Rome was able to suppress, but never wholly conquer. Cymbeline seems to deny in his heart the Roman thesis. The other British present at this conference, the Queen and Cloten, do not in principle deny the Roman thesis. Rather, they assert that the effectual truth of the thesis extends only as far as the fluctuating effectual truth of Roman military power. The conquest that imposed the tribute was made by Julius Caesar. Even that conquest was not complete. Quote, a kind of conquest Caesar made here, but made not here, his brag of came and saw and overcame. With shame, the first that ever touched him, he was carried from our coast, twice beaten. Semi-success against the great Caesar is encouraging. And Cloten proclaims, quote, there is no more such Caesars. Other of them may have crooked noses, but to owe such straight arms, none. The present Roman ruler is another lesser Caesar, Augustus. Thus, these British acceptors of the Roman thesis see an opportunity to take Britain for themselves. Quote, that opportunity which then they had to take from us to resume, we have again. The plot pursued by the Queen and Cloten is not predicated on the thought that Britain is ready and able to assume the role of Rome for the whole world, as perhaps later in time Britain did. Instead, the thought seems to be that Britain now has the resources to resist and endure Rome. Cloten claims, quote, our kingdom is stronger than it was at that time. And something Posthumus observes earlier in the play seems to give reason to think Cloten is correct in this. He says, quote, our countrymen are men more ordered than when Julius Caesar smiled at their lack of skill, but found their courage worthy his frowning at. Their discipline now mingled with their courages will make known to their approvers. They are people such that mend upon the world. However, a large part of the British confidence in standing up to Rome seems to depend upon a trust in the geographical advantages of the Isle of Britain. The Queen says Britain, quote, stands as Neptune's park, ribbed and paled in with rocks unscalable and roaring waters with sands that will not bear our enemies' boats but suck them up to the topmast. And Cloten tells the Romans, quote, you shall find us in our saltwater girdle. If you beat us out of it, it is yours. Rome responds to this with war. Quote, war and confusion, pronounced politely by a calm and courteous Roman ambassador. Part six, low ceilings and sparks of nature. This thought, that the geographical advantages may afford some measure of escape from the Roman thesis, may offer some incentive to consider the rustic mountain scenes wherein the play depicts the lives of Cymbeline's abducted sons. Bellarius, a noble and member of Cymbeline's court, was banished 20 years ago when, quote, two villains whose false oaths prevailed before my perfect honor swore to Cymbeline I was confederate with the Romans. So easy it is to take away a person's reputation. And in retaliation for the injustice done to him, Bellarius abducted the king's two infant sons. So easy it is to take away a person's legacy. Bellarius has been raising the two boys, Guiderius and Arviragus, as though they were his own in simple and isolated mountain circumstances for 20 years. The life of these three mountaineers seems idyllic and free from the cares imposed upon human beings by the threats that come along with other human beings. The ceiling of their modest cave is low, and now that they are grown, the boys must stoop. But this very fact may recommend their situation as a nurture productive of proper and sober measurement of their own dimensions and capacities. Quote, a goodly day not to keep house with such whose roofs as low as ours. Stoop, boys, this gate instructs you how to adore the heavens and bows you to a morning's holy office. The gates of monarchs are arched so high that giants may jet through and keep their impious turbans on. A natural and virtuous life seems possible here. When they hunt, the younger men take the more difficult passages, as is fitting, and whoever proves best in the day's hunt plays, quote, lord of the feast that evening, and the others act the parts of his servants. No one fears being poisoned at the meal. These men do not have much in the way of possessions, but they do not seem to live in anxiety that someone will come and take what they have. But the boys do show signs of restless ambition. Bellarius calls these signs, quote, sparks of nature, which indicates that even though the boys have been stolen away at a young age and given a rustic and simple nurture, these boys still retain kingly natures. Quote, how hard it is to hide the sparks of nature. These boys know little they are the sons to the king. In the cave wherein they bow, their thoughts do hit the roofs of palaces, and nature prompts them in simple and low things to prince it much. These stolen boys live under names that are not their own, under the guidance of a man they think is their father, who is not. And yet, Bellarius thinks he sees inextinguishable sparks of their nature showing through. Nothing in the play seems to present the claims of nature more strongly than when their natural sister Imogen, wandering about in the guise of a man and driven by urgent hunger, finds the cave of her unknown brothers and enters their lives. The siblings do not recognize each other, but they respond to each other almost immediately. Both brothers profess their love. Imogen says, as an aside, quote, would it had been so that they had been my father's sons. The affection between the unknown siblings is so strong that when the mountaineers prepare to go out the next morning and find that Imogen, under the assumed name of Fidele, is sick and will not be going on the hunt, both, out of concern, express strong love for this young man they have just met. Arviragus expresses it most strongly. Quote, I know not why I love this youth, and I have heard you, Bellarius, say love's reasons without reason. The beer at the door and a demand, who is it shall die? I'd say, my father, not this youth. this love, whose reason is without reason, differs from the love to which Posthumus aspired. Hearing his boys profess they love this newfound stranger more than they love him, Bellarius once again sees the mysterious sparks of their nature showing through. He says, quote, "O noble strain, O worthiness of nature, breed of greatness." Now, Imogen had come to this cave dressed in the clothes of a man because Posthumus, convinced of her disloyalty, had sent his servant Pisanio to lure her out into the wilderness and kill her. Pisanio does not believe the charges against Imogen to be true, and thus hatches a plot whereby Imogen, impersonating a man, will travel and enter into the service of the Roman ambassador, and thus perhaps be afforded the opportunity to gather information about Posthumus's current condition and about the causes that made him wrongly think her disloyal. Changes of clothing and impersonations are not unusual in Shakespeare's plays. But in Cymbeline, wearing the clothes of others and appearing to be someone else touches directly upon the ongoing theme of whether human beings can have and have meaningful experiences of properties that are essentially private, or whether all our properties that we can be aware of in ourselves and in others are universal characteristics, and thus in essence public. In the affection Imogen inspires in her brothers, some inner link seems to be leaking through her disguise. Now, she may also not be a wholly convincing man. Now, while she's alone and feeling ill, Imogen will take a drug she thinks is medicinal. But it is really a drug from the queen. The queen thinks that the drug is a mortal poison, but the learned and suspicious doctor Cornelius instead gave the queen a drug that produces convincing symptoms of death, but no real lasting harm. Thus, when the boys and Bellarius return home, they find what they think is a dead Fidele. Part 7, His Meanest Garment. Before the mountaineers return home, however, they run into another member of the court in disguise. It is Cloten. He is dressed in Posthumus's clothes. He is not trying to fool anyone or impersonate Posthumus. Rather, he is pursuing an elaborate revenge fantasy. Cloten has lastingly been stung by a remark made by Imogen that she esteemed more highly the meanest garment that ever clipped Posthumus's body than she esteemed Cloten himself. The status-conscious Cloten obsesses over this insult. Thus, Cloten concocts an elaborate revenge fantasy to kill Posthumus and rape Imogen while dressed as Posthumus. Wearing Posthumus's clothes does not change Cloten. He does not experience any deep revelation. He does reason, however, that if he fits well into the clothes made by Posthumus's tailor, quote, why should his mistress, who was made by him that made the tailor, not be fit too? Thus, Cloten blunders into the realm of the mountaineers playing himself, dressed as Posthumus. Cloten utters threats and insults as he is used to doing. Cloten has never lived under low ceilings. He does not know his own dimensions and capacities. But here he is not addressing himself to someone who recognizes and respects status, who will let him behave badly without consequence. Guiderius treats naturally what Cloten says and threatens to do as words and actions with natural meanings and consequences. Thus the two fight, and Guiderius cuts off Cloten's head. So when the mountaineers return and they find Fidele, or Imogen, seemingly dead, they set about to honor both of the dead with burial. And when they leave to find more flowers to put upon the grave, Imogen awakes from her death-like state to find herself alone next to the headless body of Cloten. Here is one of the most remarkable and perhaps disturbing moments of the play. Imogen mistakes this dead, headless body for the body of her husband. Of course, the body is wearing Posthumus's clothes, and Imogen is shocked and surprised, and so that might explain a momentary error. But the error is not momentary, nor is it based upon insufficient examination. Imogen feels the body and claims to recognize what she feels. Quote, "I know the shape of his leg. This is his hand, his foot mercurial, his martial thigh, the bronze of Hercules." This is a detailed claim to recognize the parts of her husband's anatomy. This thoughtful, loyal, intelligent, and serious lover claims to know her own husband, and she is wrong. If Imogen does not know the man she loves well enough to distinguish him from another man capable of fitting into his clothes, what does that suggest about the kinds of things human beings can know about and share with each other? Despite the many manifest differences between Cloten and Posthumus, there is sufficient similarity between the two that even a loving wife can confuse one for the other. Now, what weight does such similarity lend to the claim of the Roman thesis? Part 8. This is not strong enough to be believed. I've been holding off looking at the resolution of Iachimo and Posthumus's wager until now because I wanted to consider what happens in light of strong awareness of the difficulty of knowing other human beings. In Act 2, Scene 4, Iachimo returns to Italy and he proclaims victory. Why he does this may be a little puzzling, although great wealth and possibly his life are at stake. If he believed in his own thesis and cared about proving it, he has failed. But maybe the meaning of the Roman thesis for Iachimo was not so focused upon material possessions. Iachimo had said, quote, "I make my wager rather against your confidence than her reputation." So maybe the point has become whether he can take away Posthumus's belief in his wife's goodness. If so, then lying and pretending to have seduced Imogen is not incompatible with the Roman thesis. Thus, Iachimo sets out to prove his claim before the court of Judge Posthumus. Iachimo begins by reciting details of the furnishings and features of Imogen's bedchamber. Iachimo extends his descriptions twice with seemingly little effect. Posthumus says, "This you might have heard of." Posthumus seems to dismiss any further detailing of bedchamber and furniture by exclaiming, "This is her honor." Then Iachimo pulls out the bracelet. It is evident Iachimo knows how important a symbol this piece of jewelry is to Posthumus. Iachimo says it must be married to that, your diamond. Symbolically, Iachimo has carried the broken marriage into the room and placed it before Posthumus's eyes. In doing this alone, Iachimo has convinced Posthumus and won the wager, and he has shown the Roman thesis to have prevailed, at least in the realm of Posthumus's belief in his wife. Posthumus tries to resist, suggesting maybe Imogen gave the bracelet to Iachimo to convey to Posthumus, but Iachimo points out that her letter makes no mention of this. Filario tries to help out by suggesting the bracelet could have been lost or stolen, but Iachimo swears an oath by Jupiter, and Posthumus is even more convinced. Posthumus asserts he is, quote, sure she would not lose it. Her attendants are all sworn and honorable. They induced to steal it, and by a stranger? No. Philario urges patience, claiming the evidence is, quote, is not strong enough to be believed of one persuaded well of. But Posthumus is past listening. Iacomo goes on to mention the mole on Imogen's breast, but the trial is already over. If Posthumus were more accepting of the Roman thesis, then he might not have dismissed the quite real and reasonable possibilities named by Philario. And thus he could have resisted Iacomo's claims and continued to believe well of his wife. But accepting the Roman thesis must seem to Posthumus at this point to destroy the foundation of his marriage as well. In the aftermath of this apparent infidelity, Posthumus feels a raging jealousy that he had earlier declared he would not, quote, if you make your voyage upon her and give me directly to understand you have prevailed, I am no further your enemy. She is not worth our debate. Posthumus's confidence that he will not feel jealousy is based upon his wishful belief his love is wholly based on reason. He wants to claim that if he is shown he no longer has any reason to love Imogen, he will also no longer feel jealous of her favors. And in this, Posthumus is just like Othello. Othello proclaims, quote, I'll see before I doubt. When I doubt, prove. And on the proof, there is no more but this, away at once with love or jealousy. Both men are wrong about themselves. And like Othello's, Posthumus's raging jealousy turns to murderous envy. Unlike Othello, Posthumus sends an agent to perform the murder for him. And luckily for Posthumus, his agent, the loyal Pisanio, does not do the deed. Pisanio does, however, lie to Posthumus and sends him a bloody cloth. This gives Posthumus time to experience the apparent consequences of his murderous response and to reflect upon all that he has done. Posthumus is then absent from the play for a long while until we see him again at the beginning of Act 5. His thoughts seem to have mended somewhat, and he has become more open to the Roman thesis. He repents his orders and regrets that Pisanio apparently executed them. He seems to think of his wife as better than himself. He says, the gods, quote, snatch some hence for little faults. This seems to be how he has come to understand his wife's infidelity. As a little fault. As a result, he thinks so poorly of his own murderous reaction that he is resolved to die. He is coming to Britain with the Roman army, but once there, he plans to don the garb of a British peasant and to die fighting against the Romans. But is Posthumus still fighting against the Roman thesis? Part 9, Pax Ex Machina. The end of this play has upset many a reader and viewer. The Roman army is winning the war, but four British noblemen disguised as commoners, that's Posthumus, Bellarius, Guiderius, and Arviragus, enter the fray and they turn the tide. Britain defeats Rome. Posthumus switches sides again and takes a place among the Roman prisoners. While awaiting execution, Posthumus has a dream vision in which his dead family berate Jupiter for treating Posthumus much worse than he deserves. Jupiter himself appears on the stage in blatant violation of one of the most sensible laws of good stagecraft. The stage directions here read thus. Jupiter descends in thunder and lightning, sitting upon an eagle. He throws a thunderbolt. This dream Jupiter gives a clunky prophecy that later requires a torturous interpretation and proclaims that there has been no fault in his providential care for Posthumus and that everything will turn out for the better in the end. All this sets up a wild array of revelations, reunions, resolutions in the very last scene of the play. Imogen appears as a prisoner among the Romans. The queen is pronounced dead. And in her dying, quote, first she confessed she never loved you, that simile, only affected greatness got by you, not you, married your royalty, was wife to your place, abhorred your person. Iachimo confesses and repents. Posthumus reveals himself. Imogen reveals herself. They clasp or wrestle. Bellarius and the two boys are honored by the king for their deeds in the war. The fate of Cloten is revealed, and Guiderius admits he is the killer. To save Guiderius from punishment, Bellarius reveals himself to Cymbeline and reveals that the two boys are in fact Cymbeline's long-lost children. Guiderius and Arviragus are now reunited with their fidele, now revealed as their royal sister Imogen. The fate of Iachimo is placed in Posthumus' hands. Posthumus forgives Iachimo, merely charging him to, quote, live and deal with others better. Cymbeline follows Posthumus' example and pardons all the Roman prisoners. Jupiter's prophecy is read out and interpreted, and peace is declared. And in the end, there is a surprise. Cymbeline declares that, quote, although the victor, we submit to Caesar and to the Roman Empire, promising to pay our wanted tribute. This choice to restore the tribute without being compelled to do so may be seen as an act of great wisdom. It is likely this and not Jupiter's intervention that makes the prospect of a lasting peace possible. Perhaps the title character gets an important and impressive lesson in just how large he is within the scheme of the Roman world. Cymbeline has gotten this lesson without living under low ceilings. Cymbeline has just gone through a whirlwind in which everything has gone his way, but the rapid and unexpected, even accidental way in which things have worked out in his favor seem to impress him with just how easily things could have gone the other way. He lost his daughter, then he gets her back. He lost his sons, then gets them back. He escaped the deadly plans, of which he had no inkling, of his wicked queen and her son. He finds his court, now ascendant and populated by loyal and heroic relatives. He lost the war with Rome and then won the war. And now in his heart, he seems to accept the meaning of Rome. Thank you.